and load this presentation up. In the meantime, no, I'm not Dr. Berkeley Patton, but I am a colleague of Dr. Berkeley Patton, and we've been working with each other for quite a while in the community. And in my role for this project at that time, I was the deputy director of the community-based organization that actually was role was to implement and deliver the activities for the Taking It to the Pews Youth Promise program. And now my role has changed. I'm now at the university working with Dr. Berkeley Patton and other researchers there doing a new initiative called Heartland Health Network, where we'll look to try to link researchers with faith-based and community-based organizations to do some really great stuff in the community. So it's interesting how things change over time. I'm excited about giving you this information today. I have absolutely nothing to disclose. I make no money doing this, as many of us do not. I didn't want to wait until the end to do the acknowledgments. I thought it was best to do it up front, because so often we forget to thank those that have so much to do with the program that we're delivering, because we never do anything alone. It's always done as a team. And first is Dr. Jeanette Berkeley Patton. And Jeanette, can you wave? Jeanette, thanks for your leadership as a researcher. Your mentorship has allowed me to learn more about the world of research, your willingness to devote countless hours of volunteer time, and your dedication and resolve to sustain equitable community partnerships. So thanks. And Andrea Bradley Ewing, will you wave your hand? I know you're somewhere around here. There you go. Thanks for your leadership in designing the TIPS tools, those games. And for those that are interested, when I'm done with the presentation, tomorrow Andrea will present at about 1:30 on session number 5186. Thanks also to the support of our funders. As I go through this, you'll see how much can actually happen on $50,000, which we know is not a lot of money. In order to frame what happened with Taking It to the Pews Youth Promise, I first got to kind of give you some, can you hear me? Am I stepping out of it? Oh, there you go. First got to give you a little bit of framework of where we came. The Taking It to the Pews, or TIPS, is a pilot African-American church-based HIV awareness and screening intervention. That we started on about a good 4 years ago together. It's a CBPR project, which my colleague on the panel has talked about in depth, so I'm not going to go into it too much. But from my perspective, CBPR simply means teaming up. And not just teaming up to get some work done, but equitably teaming up to bring all of our resources to the table. Equitably sharing the skills that we bring, each partner, that each partner brings. Currently, I'm excited to say that there's 23 churches using the TIPS intervention model, and 6 in Montgomery, Alabama, and we're replicating down there, so we're really, really excited about that. During the pilot phase of TIPS, we facilitated focus groups and booster meetings that allowed us to have a better understanding about how to improve TIPS along the continuum. The feedback we received was to create more educational games, develop more media approaches, but much more specifically and intense, the responses from the pastors and church leaders were to focus on the youth. Provide something that specifically focuses on sex education for our youth. And we read into that and we realized that we had to have another phase of Taking It to the Pews. We had to have an outgrowth that would do just that for them. And then we focused on the comments from the focus groups and some of the comments written on the surveys. And those comments were things like, kids are more responsive to keeping it real, but we, the church, can no longer put our heads in the sand. And what that speaks to us was, they're ready to be bold. So let's capture this moment and help them be a little bold. Well, you can't be a little bold. Help them be bold. and that the youth feel left out. And what we wanted to ensure was that we did not build or develop a program or intervention that will leave out the youth, but to integrate them in the design of the intervention. So, to say all that to say, that it was time to develop a program where we taught the parents to parents and youth to talk with each other as opposed to at each other. So what we look to do is to teach parents that when you run across a situation that's depicted like this in this cartoon, when your child turns to you and says, well, what would you like to know? Your answer can simply be what you know. Share with me what you know. And then it opens up a dialogue, a good conversation for parent and youth to start talking. First goal. When you look at that first word in the first goal, it says parents. When you're talking about the Black church, parents becomes a very broad word. Very broad. See, when I was in Sister Ann Rita's class in Sunday school, I knew very well that I had to listen to, respect, and learn from her just as I would from my mother. And so we realized that our first goal was to teach the church-going adults how to communicate with youth more effectively. We decided to do that in the form of the Adult Sex Communication Seminar. And to build this seminar with community partners, which I'll talk about in a minute. The second goal was to do a seminar on sexual health and sexual refusal skills for youth, focusing on their self-esteem development, identifying values, and exercising decision-making skills. These two seminars were developed in the spirit and practice of community-based participatory research, because not only did the community-based or faith-based organization, Calvary Community Outreach Network and University of Missouri, Kansas City, sit in a room and develop these seminars in a vacuum, but we looked to the community and we said, what resources in the community can actually help us develop this? And we went to those that actually practice this. Who is talking to the adults and the youth and talking about sex communication? Who is facilitating those workshops? So we called on Campfire USA Heartland Council, a life coach group named Conscious Awareness, a licensed social worker who works with us for the last 17 years with Black Church Week of Prayer. We called on an aid service organization that we work with quite frequently, Kansas City Free Health Clinic. And then we called on our grad students, Jeanette Berkeley Patton's grad students like Aaron Moore, to say, come on in and help us develop these objectives. And so we did. And we didn't stop there. We then said, so we've developed these objectives, but we have to ensure that the church leaders, the pastors, are okay with the information that we're about to deliver. And so we needed to then take those objectives, a synopsis of the seminar, and disperse that to those pastors and say, what's your feedback? What should we change? Is this appropriate? Are you okay with this information? We got their blessing, not without making some changes, not without many different considerations, but we did get their blessing to deliver these seminars to their congregants. So third was to teach the church to deliver the youth and religiosity tailored materials and activities from the TIPS toolkit, and do it within 3 months of planning and 9 months of intervention. So it was very, very, very quick. The evaluation. What evaluation activities were used? Knowledge and satisfaction surveys distributed at youth and parent seminars, baseline and post focus groups and surveys done with the youth and parents, and feedback on the implementation of the youth of the tools. So in the first phase, I think we've made about 17 or 18 tools, and in this phase of TIPS, we developed 10 additional tools, including the sermon guide that you see in front of you. And what we did was we used the focus group time as a way, the focus group outcomes as a way to create the tools to deal with the issues that were that were presented in those group sessions, as well as to include familiar language that they used during those sessions, so that we're giving them what they asked for during those focus groups. Responsive readings. Whenever we build a tool for the Take It to the Pews toolkit, we look at the functionality of the church and we say to ourselves, we need to create tools that integrate themselves into the functionality of the church so we don't add any more to the church's to-do. They already have the capacity to do it. So with the responsive readings, they fit well into the structure of many church services and read collectively and are read collectively, engaging all church members, and also have an opportunity to role model to the parents about how to start communication with their children. Role model stories, excellent icebreakers for so many different ways. Icebreaking communication between parent and child. Tips are on this this role model story to start a conversation, and discussion starters for those small group ministries within the church, like your youth ministry, your singles ministry, your parent ministry, all of those things. And what you're looking at here is a bar graph of the of data that was provided from the 13 church partners, indicating that 141 of the TIPS YP activities were delivered over a 9-month period. Whew. On an average, that's 2 TIPS activities per month, which was more than we asked for. We only asked for 1. And approximately, get this, 3,700 church and community members were exposed to the project. The tool used the least was the text messaging, and we look at that and realize that there was a gap. We did not have a point youth ministry person that would know how to facilitate that process within the churches. So when we look to move forward in that, we'll look to fill that gap. Now, the tools used most frequently, though, were the bulletins, which my panel partner over here was talking about. Next in line to responsive readings, the sermons were running neck and neck with the other, and what other meant was other activities. So the church liaisons would have a skating party or a basketball tournament. Well, they'll weave in what next you'll see, they'll weave in screening for STI and HIV. And get this, in again, 9 months, 13 churches, 15 screening events were offered, where 147 youth and adults were screened. So it speaks volumes to the commitment of the church and their willingness to weave in HIV testing. This is my favorite right here. You can see right in the red as you read that. In the youth are saying in the last 6 months they talked to their parents about sex about 1 to 2 times, and the adults are saying, well, in the last 6 months, and these are their parents, okay, at the focus groups, in the last 6 months they actually talked to their youth 7 to 8 times. So let's interpret that a little bit, right? Data is open to interpretation, right? Maybe the conversations with the parents are starting something like, sex can wait until you get married. Just hold off. Don't do that. Wait until you go to college. Wait until you get married. You know, all of that. So that's didactic. That's a one-way conversation as opposed to a dialogue, which we want them to have is more of a dialogue. So this is, you know, the beginning. And we can also interpret that our youth, like we know, are smart. And they get it. And they know the difference of being talked at as opposed to being included in a conversation, right? Okay. Survey evaluation findings for the youth. Out of the 60 youth attending the sex education and refusal skills seminar, 87% reported understanding how to problem solve and avoid risky situations based on what they learned at the seminar. As you can see also, there was high exposure to the TIPS tools at 93% being exposed to the responsive reading, 73% to educational games. And again, you can learn more about that tomorrow. The exceptional outcome reported on the survey was HIV screening, which went up from 10% to 38%. And I do have to clarify that the sex talks with parents, the baseline was 10%, versus 33% post, not 38%. That was a typo. The downside, well, not even the downside, just look at it. Church youth are having sex. That's it. 36% at baseline, 41% at post. We need to keep talking with our youth and not talking at our youth in the church. In general, the youth commented on in the focus groups that they were more apt to have frequent communication with parents and highly motivated to delay sex. However, they did have a barrier to having open dialogue of adults being judgmental and having hypercritical attitudes about youth having sex. For the parents, I think the one that I want to really highlight here is at the bottom. Parents were less confident in discussing sex with their children. At baseline, they were real confident at 100%, but at post, it became 63%. Well, I guess they learned that there's a difference between a didactic lecture with their child and a dialogue, right? So what were the barriers of communication with the parents? They were worried about mixed messages. They worried about saying, you know, wait to have sex versus using a condom just in case you're going to have sex. And then on the bottom, the improvement. Oh, let me turn the slide there. The improvement, the last bullet, explicit sex information should be offered in non-church locations by professional health educators. In other words, don't talk about the nitty-gritty underneath the roof of the church. Don't talk about how to prevent sexually transmitted diseases when you're engaging in anal sex or oral sex under the church roof. Don't disrespect the church like that. But, however, if the community center is across the street, then walk across the street and talk about that with those healthcare professionals. So that was important feedback that we heard. In conclusion, and finally, we would be remiss not to talk about implications for future research and practice. Research strongly suggests that highly religious youths tend to engage in fewer sex risk behaviors, but limited research on how maturation and religiosity together influence sex behaviors. Possibly by a certain age, regardless of religiosity, church youth do begin to start looking like all other youth at risk. Although a great deal of youth abstinence curriculum studies exist, little has been done to develop an empirically tested, church-based sexual health curriculum for African American youth. With more youth having communication devices and access, still little is published on these, on how these devices and networks can be used to reduce risky sexual behaviors. However, we're hoping that the literature will emerge pretty soon on that. More qualitative information on the discourse of what constitutes sex communication and how this may be different based on cultural and ethnic backgrounds. So there's still the things to do and more to learn. And for the TIPS program, there's more happening. We're moving into the second phase of that TIPS program when I think we're slated to develop maybe 17 more tools. How many? About 12 more tools for the toolkit. So that's an amazing number of tools. Those tools will focus primarily on testing, getting tested, knowing your status. Thank you for your time.
Okay, they adhere to the timeline. So we have actually have, exactly, great. Great job, all four. Now we have time for questions as well as dialogue. Any comments or questions from the audience? Yes. Can you guys hear? I think you, Jason. Right. Would you repeat the question and then answer? Okay. Jason's going to repeat it so it can be recorded. Okay. Do you know?
Sure. The question had to do if we included our community members on the publications. The answer is we included people from Project Faith, from that staff, The one publication that we have out right now, Knowledge and Stigma, was from a survey that we did. It wasn't from the experience of Project Faith. So the answer is no. I mean, none of our care team members are on that publication. But in the future, I think that's certainly important to include our, particularly the religious leadership that we work with in developing these interventions. So as we move forward with future publications, that's certainly on the table.
Very good. Oh, you have, okay, you have the question? Okay. Okay. Can, do you guys hear her? Oh, the question is, okay. did the youth share
the same views as parents
regarding
whether or not to talk about anal, oral, sex, or just sex in general as a parent did in the church? Because it's talking about keeping it real.
Okay. Okay. So, okay. Did the youth share the same view as the parents regarding sex, whether it's vaginal, oral, or anal sex, or just talking about it within the church?
Underneath the church roof.
Okay.
Right? Underneath the church roof. No, absolutely not. Keeping it real means keeping it real. Your youth, they're willing to talk to you if you allow them, if you provide them an opportunity, wherever, however. And sometimes they'll give you too much information. So no, they didn't, Jeanette? Oh, there's a good, yeah, that's a good one. We had focus groups, and in those focus groups, it was on the campus of Calvary Temple Baptist Church, where I'm a member, and on one end of the, one side of the street is the church, and the other, on the other side of the street is our community wellness center. So we had the youth at the church broken up in their focus groups, and the AIDS service organizations, about three of them from in Kansas City, in different rooms for confidentiality to offer STI testing and HIV testing. And then across the street, the parents were hanging out at the Wellness Center doing their focus group. So we provided an environment where there was no barrier to access for screening. And therefore, the youth were very comfortable underneath the church roof to talk and let out their, to express their views, to give us their opinions, and to talk about anal sex, all types of sex, just sex, and they were fine with it. Yeah.
Good, very good.
Wait, y'all going nowhere.
Yes, ma'am.
I'm a college professor, so I gotta ask this. Sometimes you talk about things and they just go, yeah, 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 and don't actually pay attention. Do you have any sense of where that is?
We actually didn't ask that question during the focus groups that I can remember. Let me rephrase your question so that it's on here. I think, just to say it real quick, is were the youth listening when the parents were talking? And yeah, we just interpreted the data to give you our opinion. But you know, you could say that, yeah, I have a 17-year-old daughter, and sometimes I do sound like wah, 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 right? So that's all possible as well. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Okay, the lady in the back, if you speak loud enough for everyone. Yes.
I have two questions. One is whether you have thought about including youth in your planning process. Because I think then your findings, the question that you raised, whether what you're hearing from the kids and what you're hearing from the parents, how disparate or how congruent that is, I think if you are also including youth and part of your planning process and sitting at that table might help you to come a little bit closer to what is more valid for them.
Mm-hmm.
And I like this project a lot, and Mm-hmm. And that we think about what is healthy in terms of mind, body, and spirit. And with so many of our kids now dealing with issues around violence and dating, all of those are interrelated. And the last thing I want to say is that while you make testing available to the kids, I think you need to make testing available to their parents.
We did. We did. Yeah. That's good feedback, and you're right. But having youth at a planning session is always important. And for this project, what we did was create an environment where we had focus groups, and those focus groups then provided us an opportunity to get their feedback so that we could design the tools with integrating. Their thoughts and opinions. So the focus group provided that. However, you're right, for the planning and development of programming, to have a youth representative at that table would be fantastic.
And not just one. You
right.
That one because it's mm-hmm. everybody.
Like a community youth board, right? Or a youth cab or something. Yeah, that's a great idea. Great idea. Jeanette, you want to add anything to that one? No?
Same person, Ms. Thompson? Go ahead. Who is your question for?
Oh, I can speak in
part,
and
I'm
no
okay. Okay. All right, okay.
I'd like to commend all of the speakers on doing a very fine job and presenting their research.
Yes. Okay, we'll just go down to Roseanne, okay?
Or can I just ask that, or just give any kind of consensus?
Okay.
Beyond just like, hey, we're working together, because as academic, we get paid for it. So, mm-hmm. like, that isn't incentive enough, but, you know, so.
Go ahead, Ms. Roseanne.
I think that's a really great question, and I think the scholarship thing is actually a unique and a good idea. In terms of our project, we were funded by a foundation, and the evaluation component was actually a small dissertation fund that I competed for. But I did compensate my participants in terms of a stipend, and it was whatever they wanted to do. Uniquely enough, a lot of our participants actually donated their funds back to the church. Or at the time, because gas is going up so much, our pastors who go to many, many events were like, this is great gas money. So I really feel that's important because nobody's time is free. And this is in the spirit of volunteerism and because they're committed. And yes, we do get paid for it. But I think one of the things that we talked about a lot in our research groups was understanding the role of the church and the ideas and notion around service and what the expectations are in terms of comment, in terms of outcomes, and then also the discrepancy that there is in research and how that really is a delayed time process and that we're adding to a body of knowledge, and so outcomes are not often immediate, and really being able to communicate that openly and fairly and understanding what are things and expectations that you have up front and that we can certainly address and make sure to include, and then what are things in terms of the research process that we need to really be clear on and may not be realistic outcomes up front. But I agree, there definitely needs to be a balance in terms of what you put in and then what comes out of it.
So, in response to my mother's question,
actually. Well, my project was secondary data analysis, but in another project I work on with cancer health disparities, the Deep South Network for Cancer Control, we actually take those ideas to heart. And so one thing that we do when we're working in churches, they usually do give some type of donation at the service in that particular project. And we also have, for many of the community lay health workers that are going through training, they do get a small salary, and we built that into the budget and thought that was important for people to feel a sense of ownership in the project and also to be compensated for their time. And just on a side note, I think that point is important to say, particularly for people to put them on, oh, and we also put people on publications, which is nice because some of our community health workers that are on papers, when abstracts have gotten accepted, like last year at APHA, three people got to go to San Diego that might not have ever, been able to go to San Diego and participate on a roundtable that I did. So there are opportunities for publishing and then going to conferences as a community person and having those opportunities, which is great. But also for the churches to get that recognition in publications is important for capacity skills building. So when they decide to maybe go for a community grant in their own right as a church, they can have some record of what they've done. So.
Good. Okay. Do you all need? We have 8 minutes. Do you want to say something, Jason? Or do you want to take the other question? We'll take the other question.
No, I agree with this.
Okay.
And while we don't make a direct donation to like a scholarship fund, Project Faith did provide all the funding to do all of the intervention activities and associated activities. And many times that was things like transportation to get somebody somewhere, or to support other activities like a food pantry. So while it wasn't necessarily directly related to HIV prevention, it was certainly related to HIV prevention and HIV care, which is very important.
Mm-hmm.
And we also focused on that capacity building element as well. So if we can go in and build skills, I think that lasts a lot longer than that one-time donation. So that's really where we focused our energies, were on that capacity building to help them, build their own skills to apply for their own projects and move on in their own directions. So while we talk about HIV prevention, there are all those associated activities too that we supported. If it was a Serenity Garden, for example, for people living with HIV or people affected by HIV, that's part of the project. So those type of interventions were included under Project Faith.
Okay, go ahead.
She raises an ethical issue that I think is very, very important for us who conduct research. And because I was the PI of the study that Elisa did, Dr. Rodriguez did for her dissertation, mm-hmm. we had each of those 8 lay health coordinators were paid money. And each of the churches were given honorary. And for the longitudinal study. And if one way to get around the tax dollars, because faith-based institutions are considered nonprofit organizations, but we wanted the money to go to them without tax implications to those lay health coordinators. So if you set it up in the form of an honorary, then they can get that money tax-free. But we gave the money to the churches and also to the lay health coordinators because they were a part of our research team. They were not separate and apart. They were us and we were they. We were all one group. So monies went directly to them, a separate from their church. We didn't want their pastors to say, we'll take this money and then take their money. They put in the time, they put in the work, and we gave that money to them. And then for the dissemination, I went back to each of those churches, participated in their services, had conversations with their pastors, shared the findings with the entire congregation, as opposed to just sending them something and write. So, you have to do all the things that I think are necessary to keep the work transparent and to continue to forge those relationships.
Okay, very good. We have 4 minutes left. Okay, yes.
I just have a question regarding the last project that was spoken about.
Okay. Okay.
As we do know, in a lot of our churches, it's very heavily female. And I was just wondering also what percentage of males were involved on the, perhaps in the leadership part of the project.
Okay, so you have three questions. One was the one I'm not trying to remember. The first one was, I'm sorry. What was the gender breakdown for as male and females in that study? And the second question, were males more likely, which one was more likely to be?
Were they equally as likely
to be open?
Yes.
And the third one was?
Were there males involved in the leadership?
Okay, you got it, Mr.